Romans 12, 1 and 2. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will.
Good morning, Midway Mennonite. Grace and peace to you from God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. I know we have a number of people visiting with family members. I just want to welcome you and say how glad we are that you're with us this morning. So what is God's will in this situation? My guess is probably everyone in this room has come to a place in their life where they've asked themselves this question. We often call this discernment. We're trying as Christians to discern the will of God in a particular situation. And oftentimes that comes up in big decisions in our life. So should I quit this job? Should I take this job? Should I go down this career path? Should I marry this person? Should I make this move? Should I buy this house? But it's also something we experience in our daily life. How do we respond to this situation at our work? And we try to discern, what is God's will in this situation? And the way I think about it in my mind is often, I think about this Robert Frost poem that you all are probably familiar with, where you come to a fork in the road, and there's two paths. And in Frost's poem, he says, two roads diverged within a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. And as you probably remember, the character in Frost's poem takes the less traveled path, takes the grassy path, and then looks back later and says that made all the difference. It's a lovely scene, except I think in my own experience, it doesn't capture the angst and worry and pressure that we often experience at that fork in the road. So oftentimes as Christians, we come to this fork in the road, and it seems like there's one way that's God's will, and there's one way that's not. And what happens if I take the path that is not God's will? Will that make all the difference too? So often there's a huge amount of pressure that we put on ourselves on this place, on this decision. And what we try to do is we kind of try to stand on our tiptoes a little bit like in Frost's poem and look ahead to the two paths and see if we can kind of guess what's going to happen on each of these paths. So we're really spending a lot of time looking forward in these discernment moments. I think Paul sees the situation a little bit differently. I think Paul would say, yes, look ahead, do what you can. But I think Paul is much more interested in how you got to that fork than he is in those two forks. I think Paul is much more interested on that path that got you there than the two forks, because that, I think Paul would argue, is the key to discerning God's will. So I want to, as we're kind of going through, it's going to seem like maybe my first two points are not going to connect to this question, but I want you to keep in mind this question. This is what I'm going to return to at the end of the sermon. Is this fork, how do we discern God's will? And if you want to follow, as you saw, if you want to follow along in your Bible, we're going to be just in two verses, in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. I just want to give you just a little bit of context from where we are. In chapter 12, Paul makes a pivot. So in the first 11 chapters of this letter, Paul is taking a survey of the spiritual condition of all people. And after he does that, he finds that Jews and Gentiles all alike are sinners and in need of salvation. And Paul says that that salvation has been provided from God through Jesus Christ and his work on the cross. And then we have a switch, and it all hinges on this one word, therefore. Could you put up the first slide? This is the NRSV, so this will be a slightly different translation than the NIV. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. So I want you to look at those two words. We got therefore, and then we have mercies of God. So Paul is saying, if you really understand everything that I've laid out to you in this first part of the letter, in these first 11 chapters, this is how it's going to bear on your life. And we talked a lot about this when we were in 1 John this spring. We talked a lot about how faith and action are really two sides of the same coin. And Paul is saying the same thing. Paul is saying, if I give you all this theology in 11 chapters, but then don't tell you what that means for you, I haven't done what I need to do. I need to tell you how this should then bear on your life. And he says, this is really important, he says this is all in light of the mercies of God. And when he says mercies of God, he means everything that's been done for you that you don't deserve. So he's talking about things like forgiveness. He's talking about these big theological concepts that have been laid out. Forgiveness of sins, union with Christ, freedom from sin, salvation. So Paul is saying, in light of all that, in light of all that I've laid out for you, this is then how you two are to respond. And he says, I appeal. I think the NIV says urge. The NRSV says appeal. And this really doesn't do justice to the Greek word parakaleo, because parakaleo is, there's much more urgency behind it. It means little, parakaleo means literally to call to one side. It was sometimes used in battle. And what a better translation for this would be, I beseech you, I exhort you, I plead with you, I implore you. So you get the sense there's something much stronger going on here than I urge you. So he's going to make two exhortations. He's going to make, the first one is, I exhort you, I beseech you to offer your body as a living sacrifice. Now, this is a challenge. This is where we need to stop just for a second, because that word can just kind of bounce right off as sacrifice, and it's not going to have the same effect on us as it would the audience, the Jewish and Gentile audience who would have first read this letter. So when Paul is saying sacrifice, he's talking about the central act of worship that the Jews would have done in their temples. And what they would do is they would offer their gifts to God, things like animals like cattle, sheep, goats, doves, pigeons, and they would devote those, they would consecrate those to God, and then they would put them on the altar as an offer to God, and they would be burned up on the altar. So could you put the next slide up? So this is from Leviticus. This is where we learn a lot about the sacrificial system. I just want to read this for you. If the offering is a burnt offering from the flock, from either the sheep or the goats, you are to offer a male without defect. You are to slaughter it at the north side of the altar before the Lord. And Aaron's sons, the priest, shall splash its blood against the sides of the altar. You are to cut it into pieces, and the priest shall arrange them, including the head and the fat, on the wood that is burning on the altar. You are to wash the internal organs and the legs with water, and the priest is to bring all of them and burn them on the altar. It is a burnt offering, a food offering, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. So for the people that would have been first reading this letter, almost nothing could have been more shocking to hear than this. And that's why, the reason I point out that passage in Leviticus is because, again, we have to understand how they would have heard this. They're going to be thinking about this kind of sacrifice that they know from the temple. And so Paul is saying, I want you to offer your body as a sacrifice. Like, not just your physical body, but like your heart and your soul and your strength, everything. And what's interesting is Paul says this is your spiritual worship. And this is, again, another place we need to look at the Greek, because spiritual literally means reasonable or rational. So I ask you, does this seem like a reasonable thing to ask of people? So what sounds reasonable to me is to offer a portion of myself to God. So in response to the mercies of God, I offer a portion of my time. I offer a portion of my energy. I offer a portion of my resources, a portion of myself. That seems rational to me. That seems reasonable. And to be honest with you, even that seems hard. But that seems at least reasonable. But that's not what Paul's asking. Paul's asking for something much different. He's asking for the totality of yourself to be put on that altar. And he's saying, if you really understand what Christ has done for you, if you really understand that Christ held nothing back from you, then your only reasonable and rational response is to hold nothing back from Christ. So in preparation for the sermon, there was a lecture given in the 1970s, I think the Vietnam War was going on, by a guy named John Gerstner, and he was a professor, I think, at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And he spent like five lectures just on these two verses, which is really amazing. But He gives one on living sacrifice, and he's giving it to some young people who are preparing to go into the ministry. And he says, he heard this story once at a conference of a woman who stood up, and she said when she was a young girl, I think a teenager, she really felt that God was calling her into Christian service. And she was convinced that God was calling her to be a missionary. And even more specifically, she felt that God was calling her to be a missionary in China. So she was convinced of this calling, and this, you know, went on year after year, but she was scared. You know, this would have been a long time ago. This would have probably been the early 20th century. China was a long way off. It was a different language. At that time, it wouldn't have been as common for a woman to just go off into the mission field by herself. So she makes one request of God. She says, I prayed to God as I submitted my life one request, that God would send me a man whom I loved, who loved me, and who would go with me to China as a missionary. Which seemed like a very reasonable request in the circumstances. Here she was ready to go be a missionary. She had one request. So she goes off to college after 4 years, finishes college. After those 4 years, no husband. She then goes to seminary. So she's going to get 3 more years of special training to prepare for the mission field. Completes the first year, no husband. Finishes the second year, same thing, no husband. Finishes her third year, she's right about to graduate, no husband. And the night before the commencement in this disorder, she described herself as an angry young woman, as a rebellious missionary. All her training was done, all that training to equip her to go be a missionary in China, and the one request she had made of God, God had not seen fit to grant that to her. And she says, and Gerstner in this story recounts that she says at that moment, the sinfulness of the thing all came over her. Not that wanting to be a missionary was sinful, not that wanting to be married was sinful, but the sinfulness of laying down a condition for God to meet. And as she says, at the first time in her life, I took my hands off my life. And Gerstner ends the story by saying, If that's true of that girl, if this is a girl who spent a third of her life getting ready for missionary service, giving up comfort and security and safety, only to realize this whole time she had never taken her hands off her life, where do we come in? If after all those years she had never really offered herself as a living sacrifice, he asks, have you? I ask you the same question today. Have you? See, when Paul says to offer yourself as a living sacrifice, he means no conditions, no bargaining, no contracts with the Lord. Whatever you've got, whether that's great or small, it has to be given. And this is not a demand for missionaries or preachers or whoever. This is for teachers and business owners and tradesmen and students and nurses. This is all of us as Christians. This is what Paul is saying. If you believe that Jesus is Lord, your hands have to come off your life. And that's what you call a living sacrifice. Something is killed off, and that is the right to yourself, the right to do as you please. So this is the first exhortation. This is the first thing he's saying is, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. And then he switches, and he goes to the second exhortation. Could you put up the next slide? Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. So the first time I ever visited AMBS, which is the Mennonite Seminary in Elkhart, Indiana, I was given a tour of the campus. And one of the things that stuck out to me, I didn't know a lot about Mennonites at the time, was the Chapel of the Sermon on the Mount. And there was a Lutheran architect, and the person giving the tour pointed out that there's no right angles in the chapel and the Sermon on the Mount. And you might be able to guess why there's not any right angles. Because he wanted to reflect the history of Mennonites and Anabaptist stances on nonconformity. And that's why there's no right angles in the chapel. And I say that because, and I've said this before, there's not too many streams of Christianity who have wrestled more with the question of what does it mean not to conform to the pattern of this world. And I like that. Actually, I like the NIV translation here. It says, don't be conformed to the pattern of this world. I want you to think about this. I want this to kind of be your reference point when we're talking about this pattern. And so what I want us to think about in this second exhortation is, what does that mean not to be conformed to patterns of this world? Because whether we're aware of it or not, there is constant pressure on us to conform. I like the word mold. Some people describe it. There's patterns in the world that are trying to mold us, trying to shape us, trying to direct us. And so what is our response as Christian to that? Do we withdraw from the world? You know, some people have made that choice. They made the choice to withdraw from the world. One of the challenges with that is that's not what Paul did. That's not what Jesus did. They were right in the thick of the world. You know, they had friends with people they didn't whose behavior they didn't approve of, sinners and moral outcasts of society. So that presents one challenge for us. If we withdraw from society, we're taking quite a different path from Jesus or Paul. I heard someone recently say this quote, "The church is the only institution in the world that exists primarily for the benefit of those who are not its members." Think about that. You know, institutions typically exist for those who are within their walls, their boundaries. And he's saying this is the only institution in the world that actually exists. So right here, we actually are gathered in large part for those who are not here this morning. You know, let that sink in. That's a strange thing. That's not how institutions usually operate. It's not to say that we don't need to be focused on our internal needs, because if we neglect our internal needs, it's going to be hard to reach out externally. But a large part of who we are is for people who are not here right now. And that's hard, right? So we're called in a sense to engage with the world, but how do you do that without being shaped and molded by the world? I lived in, as most of you know, I lived for 8 years kind of on secluded on a farm in Illinois, and in some ways that was a little bit easier. You could make a lot of choices about what you wanted to be shielded from that was out in the world. And I think there's probably times that we need to discern. There are things that we need to avoid. There are things that are not good for us to expose ourselves to. But what I want to kind of point out is it takes a huge amount of intentionality to be in the world but not be shaped by the world. And what's hard is that a lot of the times the things that are really shaping us most powerfully, we don't even recognize. We're not even aware of. So I'm just going to take one example, movies. So when I was growing up, you know, we did some discernment about what movies we should watch and which ones we shouldn't. Often it was by the rating of the, you know, what my kind of parents used, the letters to decide if we could watch it or not. And actually, while I was working on this sermon, something popped up called Pure Flix, which was, I guess, like a Christian alternative to Netflix, where they were kind of promising you that all that content you're worried about will be filtered off. And what we talk about, we're usually worried about language and sex and violence. And just to be clear, like, I think these are things that we need to be aware of for ourselves, for our children. So I'm not at all saying that that's not important. But what I'm saying is often the really powerful patterns in movies, we don't even know they're there. We don't even recognize. The things that are most shaping us in the way we see the world, we don't even see. So here's a way to kind of identify cultural patterns. Think of some of the cliches. Think of some of the things that are truisms that once you state, people are kind of think, well, that's self-evident. And I'll pick out one. The line, you have to be true to yourself. You have to be true to yourself. Well, let's unpack that a little bit. What does that mean? We hear that a lot. I mean, you hear that everywhere. You got to be true to yourself. And what you mean is that life is, in a sense, a journey of self-discovery. So our task in life is to find out who we are. What makes us unique? What makes us tick? What are our gifts, what are our desires, what are our values? And life is a journey of self-discovery, and we turn inward, so I'm going to look inside myself, and whatever I discover about myself is then going to lead me to how I make choices, to what I do with my life. So as we discover who we are, then we have these things in front of us that we need to get done, and we move out on this journey to complete those things. And that is how we're true to ourselves as we fulfill those things. So going back to the movies, that's one of the most common themes in Disney films. There's lots of Disney films. There's lots of films that deal with this theme. But think about The Lion King. Simba, he listens to his father's ghost, and in listening to that, he remembers who he is. And then that then propels him to take the heir of the Pride Rock's throne and return his rightful place as king. And The Sword and the Stone, Arthur discovers he's not this puny little orphan. When he pulls the sword, he finds out who he really is, and that then propels him to be a noble knight. And in the movie Frozen, Elsa, from the outside, looks poised and reserved and regale. But who is Elsa really? She's got this secret power that she can create ice and snow. And in the song, Let It Go, it's all about unleashing who she really is. So no longer be the good girl that her family wants to be, that society tells her to be. It's time to let it go. It's time to see what I can do, to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. So I found this blog entry online. I just want to articulate this a little more. Could you put up the next slide? Called Life Lessons as Told by Favorite Disney Films. And this was somebody's take. Self-discovery clarifies our essence and value in life. It's in knowing who we are that helps us decide which choice to take or which path to tread. Again, I'm trying to think about what is it that's making us choose a path or not. So this one is, she's saying, self-discovery. Every day we encounter difficult situations, inescapable challenges, and unsettling conflicts. It's in responding to those obstacles that give us insight on our true being. Like the Disney characters, we improve ourselves by discovering who we are, and we cling to our identity to live life to the fullest. So going back to Robert Frost's poem, well, how are you going to make this decision which way to go? Well, in this, according to this kind of worldview framework, you have to know yourself in order to know which way to go. And as Christians, there's much about this we can affirm. I'm not giving the example of these films to say that we reject all of this. In fact, in verse 3 in Romans, Paul's going to say, don't think more highly of yourself than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment. And in many ways, Paul is saying, be self-aware. Like, don't think more highly of yourself than you should, but don't think more lowly of yourself either. Like, think accurately of yourself. And to think accurately, it takes a certain amount of self-awareness. So I'm not at all saying that we never look within ourselves to discover who we are. Because Paul also then, in the next verse, says, each of you has been given a gift. So a lot of times discovering our gifts, and that's one of the things we resonate with these stories, is that often these characters are discovering their gifts. And the Christian life is about discovering our gifts and then using those gifts to build up the body. And we value individuals. We value the uniqueness of individuals. But here's my point. This is not our primary question as Christians. So the driving question in our lives is not who we are, but whose we are. Let me say that again. The driving question in our life is not who we are, but whose we are. And whose are you? Well, Paul is very clear about this. Paul is very clear that you are not your own, that you belong to Jesus Christ, and that the only reasonable and rational response to everything that Jesus has done for you is to offer yourself as a living sacrifice. So while there's value in knowing ourselves, there's value in understanding ourselves and our gifts, this is not what should be the primary driver of our decision-making. Remember what was killed off at the altar? It was our rights. It was our rights to ourselves. And this is hard. As I've heard several people say and in songs, the problem with offering yourself as a living sacrifice is that a living sacrifice is always wanting to crawl off the altar. So think about it. You put a pigeon on an altar, you kill it, you burn it up, it's gone. Same thing with a sheep or a cow or whatever. But you put yourself on that altar, and your tendency is always want to get off that altar, right? You don't want to be on that altar. That's why Paul says it's a living sacrifice. Something is living, you're alive, you're not burned out, but something is killed off. The right to yourself has been killed off on that altar. And what I want to point out is not to just critique the culture around us, but to say that as Christians, we are offered something so much better than an identity of self-discovery. So let's think about this pattern, and let's look what's really happening, because there's a lot of challenges. When you are really using your own desires to make decisions, that doesn't always go well. Like, enough of us are aware that when we've actually met some of our desires, they've been incredibly self-destructive. Like, desire is not always the best determinant of what you should do. And Paul is really clear about this. In chapter 6, he talks about being enslaved to sin. And there's certain desires that will literally enslave you. I mean, there's some that we think of like gambling and alcohol and drugs, but there's a lot of other desires that enslave us that we have no idea are enslaving us. And Paul is saying, you need to be aware that these desires have the potential to enslave you. Secondly, these desires often contradict each other. So maybe I want to do one thing. I want to do a career, but I also want to, you know, maybe stay home with my kids. I mean, there's lots of examples. You may not be able to do both those desires. We come up to things in our life all the time where there's contradictory desires. We have to discern what to do about that. The other thing is that, in a sense, like what we're told is that by being who you are, by discovering the true self, you're being a unique individual. And I was talking with Christiana about this, and she told me about a priest at a conference she was at who, I think in the 70s, was like a hippie and real... A hippie, right? Right, okay, yeah. And he thought he was really being nonconformist. And then he met these nuns. And he's like, oh, man, these were the people that were nonconformists. These were the people that were radically living a different way of life. See, I mean, there's a way he thought he was being a nonconformist, but he realized he was falling into a pattern. And he saw these nuns, and he said, oh, man, they are living a different way of life, and actually ended up going on to become a priest. So I think this idea that we're not being conformed by society is false. I just want to make one more point. It's also really hard to construct meaning and identity from your life from scratch. Because that's a lot. That's kind of a great experiment that we've been asked to do, is that if you're going to jettison a lot of your past, maybe your Christian upbringing or whatever, you're going to have to construct meaning and identity from scratch. And that is way harder than our society makes it out to be. I'm going to drop all the wisdom of the past, and I'm going to look within myself, and that is going to be how I figure out how to live. Like, good luck with that. Like, that's really hard. Maybe if you're like a philosopher and you've got all the time in the world to sit around and think about that, that might be a little easier, but most of you don't have time to sit and think about that all the time. I sure don't. So it's really hard to construct identity and meaning from scratch. But here's the thing that I think is most important as Christians, is that what becomes really challenging when you follow that pattern in the world is that your performance is then rated on how you fulfill those things. So you have these desires, you have these dreams, whether it's money or a career or marriage or whatever, and then you've got to judge how successful your life is by how you meet these things. And that's really hard too, because to be honest with you, we fail at a lot of that. And what is way the good news about Christianity is that it's not our performance that gives us our worth, it's the performance of Jesus Christ. That our worth comes not from finding who we are, but because God names us, because God knows us, because he gives us an identity. So what am I trying to say here? One thing I'm saying is that there's no way I'm going to be invited to the sequel in 2019 of Frozen. I mean, if you want to invite me, that's great, but I think my family is going to tell me, don't go, don't bother. What I'm trying to say is that these patterns are hard to see. So Paul was a smart guy. Paul could have been a philosopher. Paul could have been a lot of things. And he's aware that this takes discernment, because these patterns in the world are not always obvious at first. They're hard to recognize. You know, a lot of the low-hanging fruit we recognize, but what are the patterns in our life that are pushing us in ways that are contradictory to our life as Christians? So just the simple phrase, you have to be true to yourself, when we really dig into that, we realize, well, that's not exactly true for us as Christians. Okay, last thing. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that, this is what I want to point out, you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So I want to circle back to that fork in the road that I began with at the beginning of the sermon. This is where we're trying to discern what to do, right? And do you see the path that Paul has taken us on? So I think sometimes when we get to this fork in the road, what we want is like a Hail Mary prayer that's like, help me figure out which way to go, because I don't know what to do. I'm stuck. And Paul is saying, so God is a gracious God. It's not that God is not going to answer that prayer or God is not going to guide us, but Paul is saying, if you want to discern God's will, you're going to have to do some work. And one of those first tasks is taking your hands off your life, offering yourself as a living sacrifice. If you are so tightly gripped on your life, how is God going to do what God wants to do with your life? Like, if you have not relinquished that right, it's going to be really hard for God to do the work that you're desiring God to do. And if you're not seeing some of the patterns that are shaping your life from the world, it's going to be hard to engage the world, but also not be shaped by the world. So when you come up to that fork, is this my Christian understanding of who I am that's telling me to go this way? Or is this kind of a more mainstream kind of cliche that's guiding me on where to go? You know, this is hard work. You think about, it's maybe not the perfect example, but like if I don't know you and I'm going to try to buy a gift from you for your birthday, it's a crapshoot, right? I don't know anything about you. I don't know your desires. I don't know who you are. But I got to get a gift, so I'm going to choose something. But if I'm getting a gift from my wife, and I've spent now 10 years with her, I better, like, factor that into the decision, right? Like, if I get her, like, a kitchen utensil, like, it's not going to be good. I mean, not that she really, but, like, most women wouldn't want that. But, like, I better use some thought, right? Like, so, because I know her. I know what she desires. I know what she loves. Sorry, that was not probably the best example of the kitchen. Okay. I know what she loves. I know her passions and her interests. But yet we have something different with God. Like, if we haven't worked to shape our desires around God's desires, it's going to be hard to make a decision on what is God's will. Because let me tell you something. We are excellent at self-deception. Every one of us is really good at self-deception. Of saying, I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to discern God's will. But really, what is it? We're looking for confirmation about what we've already decided. I mean, think about who you go to for advice when you want a decision. At least myself, like, I usually want to go to the person who's going to say, that's a great idea, Matthew. You know, but probably what I ought to do is go to the other person and say, like, you're going to speak honestly into my life. Like, tell me what you think I should do. And that's way harder, because you may not want to hear that. And that's kind of what we need to get to at this point with God, is we need to get to a point in this fork of the road where, like, God, speak into my life. I've taken my hands off my life. I've worked to offer myself as a living sacrifice. Help me discern what to do. And I just want to say one last thing. There's going to be times you reach that fork where you have done that hard work and you honestly don't know what to do. You stand at that crossroads and you don't know what to do. And here's my advice. I actually was in a Skype call with Greg Boyd one time through AMBS. He's a kind of Anabaptist-leaning pastor in Minnesota. And I asked him a question about this. I really liked what he said. He said, when you reach this point, you got to move. You can't just stay paralyzed. You have to make a decision. And he said, what I do when I'm not sure is I make a decision, but I give God the right to interrupt my plans. And I like that because sometimes we don't really know what to do, and we have to just move forward. You can't just stay paralyzed. But I think that's really important to say, God, I'm going to make this decision, but I also give you the right to interrupt that plan because what I want most is to discern your will, is to follow your will. And that way we don't just get paralyzed at this thing, thinking that there's only one way and we have to choose that way, because I think God is much bigger than that. I think if we take the wrong path, I think God can still work with us. But I think we need to do the work to try to choose that path that God is calling us on. Please pray with me. Gracious God, thank you for these words of Paul, these hard words, Lord, of offering ourselves as a living sacrifice, Lord. But these are life-giving words, Lord, because we know in our life when we take these chances, when we put ourselves on the altar, so often, Lord, we see the fruit of that. We see what the good is when we can let go of our lives and let you take more control of our lives, Lord. And I pray for strength and discernment for each person in this sanctuary this morning. As they come up to the major decisions in their lives, Lord, I ask for that they do the work to discern your will, Lord, and that you honor that work, Lord, and you give them peace in their decisions. In Jesus' name, amen.